Darn right. I forgot the clicker. It's a problem. All right. So, we're dealing with the study of the Bible. And as you know, we're to the last section of it and dealing with the English Bible. Remember what they called John Wycliffe? What was his special title, nickname, we might say, that he wore with regard to the Reformation movement? He was the morning star of the Reformation movement. You can see up there the English theologian, philosopher, church reformer, promoter of the first complete translation of the Bible into English, and that, of course, is what we're concerned with. He was one of the forerunners of the Protestant Reformation movement. So a very courageous man, took a stand against the Catholic Church when that was an unpopular thing to do. He basically stood alone. And so we appreciate his courage and his conviction with regard to that, but especially that he produced that first English Bible. Remember now, that was a translation from the Latin Vulgate, is what he was working on. Then after the Middle Ages, as we enter into the Renaissance period, the printing press was invented. And Johannes Gutenberg was the fellow that came along with that. They call that Bible, the Gutenberg Bible, sometimes referred to as the 42-line Bible. But that was, of course, a wonderful invention and got the ball rolling over the next 50 years or so. A lot of things were happening, and ultimately this began the printing revolution, and so we benefited from that with regard to producing the Bible. And then, of course, I kept calling him Aramaeus last time, didn't I? Did anybody notice that? Did everybody notice that? And you said nothing. You said nothing to me. Erasmus is his name. I appreciate him because the fact that he had the right attitude, I believe. Like, I'm not saying that he was perfect in every way or even a true Christian, really. He fell short. At the end of the day, he was a Catholic priest. But he really had the attitude that I think most of us probably have or should have. He was an independent thinker that didn't go along with any crowd just because it was popular. And as a result of that, what happens when you are like that is he ended up kind of alone, really. And everybody involved, all the powers, both the Catholic Church and the reformers, were kind of against him. And so that was the state that he was in. The Encyclopedia Britannica says his independent stance in an age of fierce confessional controversy, rejecting both Luther's doctrine of predestination and the powers that were claimed by the papacy, made him a target of suspicion for loyal partisans on both sides and a beacon for those who value liberty more than orthodoxy. And that really is us. Like, you may not even realize it because you haven't been, it depends on who you've been talking to, what conversations you've had. But when I was on the radio program, people would call up all the time, and their main charge against us was that we weren't orthodox. And that, with regard to the Protestant movement, that is hugely important. I've often argued people like the Reformed Baptists and other people who think that they come from the Protestant movement. They think being Orthodox is all important. And to me, they think more highly of John Calvin and Martin Luther and all of the important reformers than they do the Bible, just about. Now, they would deny that, of course. But in going back and forth with them on the radio and other places, that's their main thing. Well, you don't believe that you're born in sin? that you don't believe what John Calvin taught, you're not orthodox. And they would, well, here's, he comes along, and Erasmus, and again, he's a beacon for those who value liberty more than orthodoxy. And I do too. I hope you do too. I hope, you know, that we all have that kind of independent attitude, that it doesn't matter what the majority is saying. Doesn't matter what people call orthodox. What we care about is what the Bible teaches. And that's how, and that's why I say he's one of my favorite characters in that area, because that's the attitude that he had, though it resulted in him kind of being lonely and alone and mistreated by both sides. But there you have it. It's what we must expect. But the most important thing about him, with regard to our study, is that he was he published the first Greek New Testament. That was in 1516. And then he published four more editions. Remember what we said. We're not going over it all again this week. But remember that he kind of did it with haste. He only had seven manuscripts to work with. That's important to remember. And they were all very late. And five of them were I believe, 15th century, 12th century manuscripts. And so he didn't have a whole lot to work with. And he was trying to get it to the press very quickly. And so that first edition of 1516 was full of errors and things. Well, he came up with another edition a few years later in 19 and corrected a lot of those errors, but not all of them, but a lot of them. And then in 22 and 27 and 35, he continued to revise it and put out new ones. And that's sort of how that worked. With all the translations that set forth, there were always additions and revisions of it. And so, like when people start to talk about, you know, and I hesitate because, I don't want to come across as if I'm anti-King James. I love the King James Version. And so I want to be on record to say that. I've used it most of my preaching. But it's only the King James only people that kind of get on my nerves and think that it's inspired when it's not. And when people say, well, no, you have to use the King James, my first question would be, really? Which version of it? The 1611 one or one that came after that? And because just like any translations, there have been a lot of updates with regard to it. So the idea that a translation is inspired just isn't meeting with the facts. Now, with this particular one, the second edition was the one used by Martin Luther as he translated it from the Latin Vulgate into German. And then what we're interested in, the third edition was used by William Tyndale. So he was translating that into English. And that, of course, brings us to the next step in the development of the English Bible. William Tyndale is referred to as the father of the English Bible. And that is absolutely accurate in a lot of ways. He produced the first edition, critical edition of an English Bible translated from the original text. And that's the only reason why, with regard to the English Bible, that we think about the how important it was to come up with the Greek New Testament, and that's why that's so important. Today we want a translation from the original, and Tyndale is the one that came up with that first. And so you can see he was born in 1494. I can't recall how much of his life we went over before, but he was born into a kind of wealthy family. His family were landowners, farmers, and that led to wealth. And so when he was 12, they sent him to Oxford to get his education, which, you know, that's very significant. That's a wonderful place to get an education in those days. And he studied relentlessly. And by 1515, when he was 21, he had gotten his master's degree, and that was important. But even more impressive was that he had learned eight languages. So he became really a great linguist that served him well over the years. But then he went to Cambridge and furthered his education there. And Aramis was there. Why do I want to call him Aramis? That is in my mind. Erasmus was there. That's in my mind. But he was probably, Erasmus was the professor of Greek at the time. And it's unclear, at least to me, how much interaction they had. But it's also clear that Erasmus had a pretty good influence, whether it was direct or just by reputation. There had to be some direct contact with him in Tyndale. And so he had some influence on him. And probably more than we even know, because they both had the same mentality. Remember, Erasmus was like Wycliffe in that they had this desire to get the Bible to the common people. And that's what's so important to us. That you know, it's because these men who don't know us, didn't know common people, didn't have a relationship with everybody, obviously, but they just thought it was right for the average individual, for the peasant, for everybody, from the Pope to the peasant, to have access to the Bible, not just clergy, so-called, not just priest and the dignitaries of the Catholic Church, but everybody should have access to the Bible. We live by the Bible. We develop a relationship because of what we learn from the Bible. Everyone needs to have access to the Bible. And that was their attitude. That wasn't the common thinking. The Catholic Church believed that was dangerous for everyone to have the Bible. Because the way they put it is, if the common man had access to the Bible, then everybody's going to come to their own conclusions and about what the Bible teaches, and there's going to be all of this false doctrine. And, well, is there any truth to that at all? Yeah, kind of. But the way they had it, only the priest had access to it, and guess what they were doing? Corrupting the Bible. And there was a bunch of false teachers, only it was only among them. And so Wycliffe and the rest of them, they didn't share that opinion. Their desire was to get the Bible to the common man. And William Tyndale had that same kind of spirit. So he, as he grew in life, he went back to his home in 1521. And I think I mentioned last time, he became a tutor to the children of Sir John Walsh. And John Walsh was a person who would often have people in his home, very hospitable fella, and they would have dinner for people, and mostly Catholic dignitaries and priests and things. And they would get into Bible studies and Bible discussions. And William Tyndale would listen in and sometimes get involved and get into discussion. And as time went on, then he would disagree with them. And he would realize that these priests don't know what they're talking about. as he himself said, he realized those priests were ignorant. And it is just a common, really, it's not that he was arrogant. If you read about William Tyndale, he wasn't arrogant at all, really. With all of his education, what he had, what sometimes can lead to arrogance, he wasn't that. But when he talked about the priest being ignorant, he just learned as he studied and listened to them. He learned that he doesn't have to take their word for things just because they were these important people, clergy in the great Catholic Church. And the more he listened to them, the more he realized that they were wrong about things. And finally, the more he listened to them, realized they don't hardly know anything. And so, it wasn't arrogance. I think most of us who preach the gospel, when I first started preaching, you have a great deal of respect for those who come before you, who preach the gospel, who know more than you and have more experience. But it's kind of important to get to the point where you realize that even these people, even people that know more than you and have studied more and have more experience, can be wrong. Because the alternative to that is you just take whatever anybody says, any preacher that you respect, whatever they teach, oh, he knows more, been preaching a lot more, he must be right. And that can be a problem. You have to come to your own decisions by your own study of the Word of God. That's important for you all. It's important for everybody. How much air has been entered into a local church sometimes because they just take what the local preacher says. Well, you know, he's the local preacher. He's the preacher. He studies. He must know. No. That's the wonderful thing at this time. None of us are inspired. We all have the same access to the same Word of God. So your responsibility, you have a responsibility to study just like I do. And the only advantage that I have over you, and it's a blessing, I think, for me, and I should never take it for granted, is that I get to study more. That's it. Like, it is a wonderful blessing that I get to study the Bible for a living. I don't take that for granted. And I remember having a conversation with Jerome Sasanecki once in my office right before he started preaching full time. And I told him, you just wait. When you start preaching full time, your knowledge is going to take off. Well, why do you think that is? Because now he gets to, every day, he gets to get up and study. And that's wonderful. It is a wonderful blessing. But that's the only advantage that preachers have. You have the same access to the same book that I have. And so you ought to have that same attitude. I have the same access to the same book of preachers who have more experience than me, been preaching longer and whatever. I have the same access. So I'm not going to just take for granted what they teach. I'm going to go to the Bible myself and see. And there's been times when I've realized, you know, this group, whatever that group is, might be a group of editors. And that group, they don't know any more than I do. These scholars over here, I think I said Sunday, I have a great deal of respect for scholars in their particular field. But when denominational scholars start talking about doctrine, I'm not that impressed. Is that arrogant? No, I'm not trying to be arrogant. I know they're smarter than I am. I know they might be more educated, might have more experience. But listen, if they were accurate in all of their doctrinal things and come to the right conclusion, they wouldn't be who they are. They wouldn't be in the situation that they're in. And so, you know, everyone has to realize you got to study for yourself. Now, I said all that was a long aside. Just to say that Tyndale got to the point with all of these dignitaries, all of these priests and things that he had a lot of respect for, he stopped to listen to them and what they were teaching. And no, that's wrong. No, the church is wrong with this. No, I can't go along with that. And then with regard to the average priest that he met, he realized they're teaching all kinds of things. Like he had ran into one Catholic priest. They were in one of these discussions at John Walsh's house. And one said, we better be without God's law than the popes. And that's the way they really felt. Because the pope, he is the head of the church on earth, and he'll just say something and we all go along with it. So what do you have when you have that? When everybody just, whatever the Pope says, that goes. What are you going to have? Well, you're going to have unity. But you know what it's not? It's not what Paul described in Ephesians 4, unity according to the Spirit. It's just unity. God doesn't want unity at all cost. He wants unity. Unity is important, and division is hurtful in the religious world. But you don't want unity just because you're going to take man's word for something and not ever challenge it. You know what you have then? Then you have the Jehovah's Witness Church. The Watchtower. Whatever the Watchtower says, that's it. That goes. And don't go against the Watchtower. Now, you don't want that. See? But that's the way the Catholic Church thought. And so, you know, it's better to listen to the church. We'd be better off without the Bible, without God's law, with the Pope than the other way around. And that irritated William Tyndale. I mean, to him, that was just a terrible way to think. And so he said, I defy the Pope and all his laws. If God spared my life ere many years, I will cause a boy that driveth the plow that shall know more than the Scriptures than thou dost. And I've seen the same quote instead of at the end saying, then thou dost, it'll say, than the Pope does. So it depends on what quote you take. But that was the attitude that he had. And by the way, that reminds you of Erasmus. When he said, I would hope that the farmer might chant a holy text at his plow. Think Tyndale maybe heard that quote from him? Probably. But they had that same mentality. They wanted the common person to have the Bible. So, William then, after he had these discussions and things, he finally, in 1523, he decided that he'd go to London and he'd ask the Bishop of London if he could translate the Bible into English. And that was kind of naive for him to think, oh yeah, like the Bishop of London goes, oh, you go ahead and do that. But I think he probably really thought he would get that permission. But the bishop said, no way. Not about to allow that to happen. By this time, the Reformation movement is going strong. It's like we're like 7 years into the Reformation or something like that, but it's going strong. And the last thing he wants, a bishop of London, is for the Reformation to hit England. So he said, no, we're not going to let you do that. And so he realized then, Tyndale realized, all right, I'm not going to be able to achieve my dream of getting the Bible to the common person and having an English translation of the Bible here in England. So he went into Europe. He went to Germany, to Hamburg, first of all, and he started with his translation, and he completed his translation, most people believe, in Hamburg. Some people think it was Wittenberg and that he actually did it under the oversight of Luther himself. But that's debatable. But he finished it, and he knew that there was a printer in Cologne, German. And so he went there to have his New Testament printed. But when he was there, the printer's house was raided. And so he had to quickly gather up all the work that he had done, the manuscripts that he had, and had to flee. And he was, you know, he was able to get away. He escaped there. But that tells us that by that time, he was a hunted man. And really, for the rest of his life, he was on the run. And he had to do things secretly and remain hidden from all of the Catholic authorities and even from the king and all of that. The king wanted him dead. The Pope wanted him dead. So he was in high. Most of the good work that he did with regard to the Bible, he did while he was on the run and undercover. And so that was just the lot that he was in. So he eventually ended up in Worms, Germany, and he had everything done. He started to work on the Old Testament because, see, we've just been talking about the New Testament. But in 1530, he completed the Pentateuch of the Old Testament. In 1531, he got finished the book of Jonah for whatever reason. And then in 1534 and 35, he revised Genesis and did two more translations of the New Testament. He did a lot of work, and all of that, again, was undercover and on the run from place to place as he was doing his best to get the Bible out to people. But in 1526, when he first finished the New Testament, he made several copies. There were several copies being made. In fact, 3,000 copies were smuggled back into England. I had at least one source to say that it was 6,000 copies. The more conservative, though, is 3,000. It said that he smuggled them in barrels of flour back into England. And so now the Word of God in English is being spread abroad in England. And the Bishop of London is furious. The Archbishop of Canterbury began to buy up as many copies as he could and destroy them. Never dawned on him that the more copies he bought, what he was really doing was funding Tyndale, and helped him to make more editions of his New Testament. That's what he did all through those years, and it's very valuable, the work that he did, and started the ball rolling towards us having an English Bible in our hands. So he's the father of the English Bible. Now, in what happened was in 1535, or I guess it would be a few years before that, 1534. So he was betrayed by a friend, a fellow by the name of Henry Phillips. Henry Phillips was born into a wealthy family. His father, Richard, was a part of Parliament three different occasions, and he was the sheriff of Antwerp for twice, and he was a very wealthy man. And he sent his son Henry on a mission, and he was some transaction, don't know exactly what it was, some transaction that he was supposed to do. You know, he went, his father gave him a lot of money to do it, and this Henry Phillip was himself a very educated man. He'd gone to Oxford, got a degree in civil law. His life was looking pretty good from a wealthy family, all of that, but he had a problem. And that problem was he liked to gamble. So when he went to do this transaction, he found himself, he had to go to London, a big city, and guess what he did? You can guess that he gambled all that money away. So now here he is. He's a person, again, he's educated. He's from a well-to-do family, a very well-known family, a very influential family. He's wealthy himself. He has all this going, but now he's in a mess, in a bind, and he's the perfect candidate for the enemies of Tyndale who can't find him. They've been searching for him for many years now. And they can't find him. And so this fellow's a perfect candidate, they think, who can find him and trick him so that they could capture him. And as the history went, that's exactly what happened. He eventually, through contacts that he had, running some of the same circles, and he got in good. He found out where Tyndale was and got in good with him. He was a very friendly fella, and Tyndale invited him into the home where he was staying, and they had a relationship over just a couple of week period of time. He really ingratiated himself to Tyndale, and one thing led to another. It took some time, but he ended up going. They were going to go out for lunch or something, and in those towns and cities in England, you would have, some of you, you know, you've done a lot of traveling and things, and you know, in those towns, there's a lot of small alleys and different roads that are curvy, and some are under shadows to the place where they're dark, no light in there, till you get to the other side. And so Henry Phillips is leading him right to some officers that are going to arrest him. And that's what he did. And so he was taken and arrested. He spent the next 18 months in a dungeon, a rat-infested, damp dungeon, it was just miserable. And that was his lot. Finally, after 18 months, they brought him out, and he was on trial, of course. And they went through some things that they did in those days. They scraped his hands. It was just a symbolic thing that they did, and put him on some clothes of the priest. And the only reason they put him on those clothes was to take him right back off. They did all of this in public. Gave him the elements of the Lord's table just to take it away from him in front of everybody. And all of that symbolically meant we're stripping him of his priesthood. And so, you know, that's what they did. And then they took him back. For what we don't even know why, they took him back to prison for another 2 months, and then they brought him back out, and then they executed him. They, in front of everybody, they put him on a stake, and they put wood all around him, put a noose around his neck, and And as they were doing all of that, he made the famous statement. He said, I pray that the eyes of the King of England will be opened. And then they strangled him to death and then set him on fire. It was only the Anabaptists that they actually burned alive for whatever reason. But so he escaped that kind of torture, but they strangled him to death and then lit his body on fire in front of everyone. And so in his early 40s, he ended up becoming a martyr. He died for what he believed in with regard to the Bible. And when you stop and think of it, here are the charges that were actually brought against this man. He maintained that faith alone justifies. Now, I want you to think about these charges. He taught that to believe in the forgiveness of sins and to embrace the mercy offered in the gospel was enough for salvation. He asserted that human tradition cannot bind the conscience. He denied the freedom of the will. He denied that there is any purgatory. He affirmed that neither the Virgin nor the saints pray for us, and he declared that neither the Virgin nor the saints should be invoked by us. Now, here's the ironic thing to me. A lot of those things, of course, we would agree with, purgatory and praying to Mary, and those kind of things we would all agree with. But you notice some of the things he died for, it wasn't truth. Like justification by faith alone, he became a reformer. He was in good now with Luther and all of that. He basically adopted Calvinism, even before that was coined, before John Calvin. But, you know, he denied the free will. See, and Erasmus had that problem with Luther, remember, and that's why he stood alone, because he would not deny the free will. But Tyndale did, see. And so this is a great reason. When you look at this and why he was put to death, it kind of explains why the Reformation movement really never accomplished what the Reformers wanted it to. Because they may think it did, but it never really did, because they believed a lot of error. That's why later on we needed the Restoration. See, but anyway, those were the charges brought against him. That's why he was put to death. Now, before we close and move on to the next step in all of this, the influence of William Tyndale. Again, he was the father of the English Bible. And it means more to you than you probably really even realize, because he's the first one to translate from the Greek to the English. And he was a wonderful linguist. He had a way with words. And so as he translated it, he translated it in ways that stayed with everybody and that has stayed with us, so that he coined different words and phrases that we now are very familiar with. For example, congregation instead of assembly. We have that because that's how he translated that. He could have translated a different way, but that's the way he translated it. Love instead of charity. The King James has charity. It love. Repentance instead of just penance. Passover, scapegoat, mercy seat, long-suffering. The kingdom of heaven is at hand. These are all specific ways in which he translated the original Greek that could have been translated differently, but he translated in ways that stuck with us. The salt of the earth, consider the lilies of the field, how they grow, meek and lowly in heart, eat, drink, and be merry. Only begotten son. You familiar with those terms and phrases? Of course we are. And even though we have translations now sometimes that worded a little bit differently, those has really, they're indelibly planted in our minds, aren't they? So William Tyndale, that's his doing. It's his translation. And they kind of stuck. And so now we use, just to show you how much influence he had. Above the fact, you know, the most important thing is that it was the first step and the English Bible having free reign of among us. And so that we're blessed with having that today. Well, then comes Miles Coverdale, and we don't have time to really get into him, but it's very interesting. He's the first one to produce the complete Bible. Now, if you were listening, you realize that William Tyndale, as much as he did as much as he could before he was put to death. But there were still some things undone. He didn't do the complete Old Testament. And I don't believe Revelation. I think that was missing, or at least there were some problems with it. So there was still work to do. And before he even died, in 1535, we see Coverdale completing his work. He came up with, in Europe, the complete Bible, both Old and New Testament. And so he used the Vulgate for the Old Testament, and used Tyndale's for the New Testament. But he completed it. But now in England, it was still against the law to do that. In fact, right about his time, there was a boy from a little eastern city in England who was set on fire for having a copy of the Lord's Prayer. That's all he had. It was one page, one sheet. And they put him to death, a young boy. So in England, it was still a big problem. But it was about to change. Right at this time, late 1520s, something was happening that was going to change everything and open up the way for the English Bible to flourish. And we don't have time to get into it right now in detail. We will. But you know what it was? It was a king in a bad marriage. That's what it was. A king who was probably a pretty good king, but a terrible husband, led to us having the English Bible in part. So we'll talk about that on next week.